Hello, friends. Welcome to Our Southern Community, your public affairs program exploring the people and the issues of the environment, energy, and economics across the region. Today's program is a focus on the environment, literally and culturally. We have with us David Weintraub, the Executive Director of the Center for Cultural Preservation. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Ned.
And your new adventure and enterprise is the Center for Cultural Preservation, and we are going to talk about that and, what really fascinates me, turtles. So that's the teaser for the listener. Let's start talking about the Center for Cultural Preservation, a relatively new project for you.
This is something I've been doing kind of nights and weekends for a number of years, but finally jumping in full time, which is keeping alive the history and heritage of our elders. I started off doing this in South Florida with my first film about Yiddish culture and one about African American culture, but now I'm able to focus full time on keeping alive the ethnic groups, the ethnic history and heritage of Western North Carolina, as well as looking at environment and culture.
How do you focus on an aspect of what culture to preserve?
That's a great question. I think at this point in time, and it's what excites me. I get to choose, which is kind of cool, but ultimately as we grow as an institution, I think we'll probably have a more deliberative approach. I've been fascinated with the history of this place, and to live in an area where culture is still alive, that goes back many generations, you know, with the Cherokee back 11,000 years, fascinated with the efforts to maintain and preserve and protect. You don't have to go to a museum to enjoy the music, the sustainable ways that people live their lives, because there's still people living that way, and there's still people performing the old-time music.
And I'm guessing, but the preservation of traditional music, whether Native American, local, you know, mountain music, really, I think there's been a lot of effort into that. But there's so much around that, beyond just the music, that just doesn't seem like it's necessarily adequately being preserved.
Yeah, it's not. There's little pockets here and there, but as an environmentalist, I feel that the best way to sell people on the value of living a sustainable life is not looking at some newfangled technology quite so much as looking back a few steps, a few generations, to look at how people live their lives. And, you know, that 99% of the things that people used to live their lives came from the ground, came from things they created themselves. It didn't come from a Cisco truck backing up in your town every 2 hours or from China.
The traditional techniques and lifestyles seem to some, I'm sure, as being, well, frontiersy and tough and rough life sort of a thing, but in reality, most of them were really practical approaches that made sense for where they were, fed the people, made the clothes. And yes, it wasn't the ultimate life in suburbia, but it worked. And it just seems like there's an awful lot of value in there that is in the process of being lost. I mean, there's been the Foxfire books and other efforts, but there's just not that much work being done to preserve those techniques, that culture.
That's very true, and it's interesting you bring up the Foxfire books, because I kind of see that this effort is in that lineage. To keep that alive and being able to tap into the multimedia aspects, to do oral histories on video, to be able to create documentary film, to be able to get this, you know, in all the media options that are available today so that people can really get a taste of it in a tangible way. And the other thing, just for me and for, I think, you know, anyone who hears that, is just the notion of wealth. We live in this society where we've kind of skewed what wealth really is. I have, you know, all kinds of fangled, you know, devices and things, and I live like a king compared to my grandparents. Yet when I meet some of these elders, whether it's African American or Cherokee or mountain folk, and hear that they thought they were rich, they thought they had everything, and they did, because they had all the food they needed to put on their table, they had their community, you know, if something happened or there was a problem, they knew they could count on the people, their neighbors. And today, you know, I look at my life, and I don't know anyone, including myself, who has the kind of wealth that they had, and some of them still have today. It kind of puts your own life in perspective, that the things that you most value sometimes aren't the stuff that you have.
And David, I think it's reasonable to point out for a few listeners that may not be aware that you really do have quite a bit of experience with videography as well as running a nonprofit. You were executive director for the Environmental Conservation Organization in Hendersonville. You produced quite a few videos. So this is really an extension of your experiences as opposed to just trying out something new.
Yeah, I kind of see this as a culmination in a lot of ways. I've been running nonprofits for over 30 years, from being a community organizer to a civil rights attorney to an environmentalist, running arts and cultural programs. You know, I see my life and where my passion lies is the intersection between natural heritage protection and cultural heritage protection. In a way, the Center for Cultural Preservation is able to tap all of that. Look at the environment and land protection from the perspective of heritage and from the people who live their lives. It's interesting how historical preservation typically means buildings. And environmental protection usually means, you know, these days it often means green technology. Oh, I drive the green car or I have panels on my roof. It often means stuff again. And yet it's the people and it's the culture, it's that wisdom. And that's kind of where I think the center is able to tap the elder wisdom that connected our society, all society, for thousands and thousands of years that's being lost. History doesn't come from a Google search or a Facebook page or a YouTube video. It comes from people. The only way to revive that is to learn it from the people who are what I call kind of the keepers of the flame.
The fragmentation of society is really a tough one to deal with because the very nature of that fragmentation means you lose track of previous generations, literally your own neighbor. I mean, how many people live in apartments or condos and often literally clueless as to who lives next door? Whereas that kind of a scenario is would probably be viewed as insane in almost any other indigenous culture or anywhere around the world. You know, you should know who's next door to you.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't necessarily depend upon the infrastructure or construct where you live. I remember where I grew up in Brooklyn. I was born in public housing in Brooklyn, and you know, we had a very tight community. I mean, you know, people made all the candy for Halloween, and you know, everyone knew each other's business. Whether you know, that sometimes that wasn't such a good thing, but there was still that sense
small town mentality. But still, the good outweighs the negative in those situations most of the time.
Yes, definitely, I believe so. You know, that's what excites me about approaching environmentalism on this different canvas, approaching it through the culture and through the heritage. But to be able to really have that big tent mentality to bring everybody in, I think we can do that through the stories of our ancestors. That's what my mom taught me. My mom was a librarian, a school librarian, and she used to put this magic carpet down, and all the kids would close their eyes. They'd open their eyes, and she'd be singing songs from that particular culture, and she'd serve food from that culture. She'd dress up in the costumes of that culture, and she brought alive, you know, our stories are so unique and exciting, and often they're the same stories when it comes down to it.
And you've taken this interrelated approach, a holistic approach, with your current project, which I briefly mentioned only about turtles at the very opening here, and the approach to it, it's a very inclusive one that includes not only literally the environment and habitat of the turtles, but also the cultural references, the historical view of turtles, the role in human culture. So that's a new way to look at turtles.
It certainly is. And turtles, in a way, play this ambassador role in the ocean. I hate to use the term because it's so overused, but you know, the canary in the coal mine, I mean, the ocean is the coal mine. And we're seeing so much implosion in the ocean itself. But when you have a contact with turtles, whether they be sea turtles, the eastern box turtles in our own community, or the bog turtles, it connects you with the entire fabric of the environment. And I was smitten just about a year ago. Me and my wife were celebrating our anniversary in a little island off of Charleston. My wife says, come out to the beach. There's all these women with fluorescent shirts on, and there's something going on. I don't know what it is. We ran out there, and I just happened to have my camera with me. 95 little baby loggerhead sea turtles were coming out of a nest. They had about 12 members of the turtle patrol, and because it was daytime, the turtles didn't know which way to go.
They're directed by the light.
They follow the light, usually the light on the horizon, but of course everything was light. And so they were going in all these directions, and typically the Turtle Patrol would kind of direct them, but they needed all, they enlisted everybody who was on the beach. And there were these amazingly cute little things that we helped to get out to sea.
That must have been a really impressive experience to see the turtles pop. I guess boiling is the term for it, coming out of the sand and heading to the beach.
Yeah, a lot of groups call them boiling because when you see these turtles come out of the sand, they're kind of like popping out on top of each other. First, you see a little bit of bubbling, and then all of a sudden, you know, 120 little hatchlings are coming out all at once, and it looks figuratively like a boil. Except at the end, there isn't soup. There's a
If they're lucky.
Getting out to their 300-mile trek to the Sargasso Sea to be able to feed for a number of years, get themselves big.
And that initial hatching or boiling is in many ways the first of all kinds of challenges just getting to the water. Isn't there, left to their own devices, isn't there a pretty high mortality rate to begin with?
There is a huge mortality rate even before you get to that point. My understanding and looking at some of the cultural history and the natural history is that raccoons, there never were the amount of raccoons we have today in the past, but raccoons are major predators. They'll eat the eggs. The ghost crabs are major predators. And, of course, beach development itself has, in many places, changed the high tide line itself. So the mothers are coming back. Remember, you know, when they hatched at least 30 years ago or more before they became sexually mature, so they're coming back to the beach after 30 years, and things have changed. So they're often laying their nests in a place where the whole nest might be washed out to sea. And so the turtle patrols play a really critical role in places where they exist to be able to actually move the nests after they're laid back further up beyond the high tide line. There's some conflict about how many turtles actually make it, but some say as small as 1 in 1,000 or as few as 1 in 10,000 hatchlings will actually make it to adulthood. Given the predation from the egg stage to predation from the little hatchling stage, the boat strikes, the nets, toxicity in the ocean, even the issue of temperature. Scientists have determined that if the temperature is above a certain level during 60% of the nesting, then the turtles will be all female. Males do play a little bit of a role there, at least in the fertilization stage, and without them, could upset the balance.
Is what you're describing an overview of the sea turtles' habits and behavior? I'm just thinking that they live a long time, don't they?
Sea turtles do. There's 7 varieties of sea turtles. On the east coast of the United States, we have, I believe, 5 of those turtles. And some of them, in the 1980s, Kemp's Ridleys were down to about 300 nests. There had been video taken in the 40s, I believe, and there was 40,000 nests that were photographed by somebody on one day. They were struggling, and Kemp's Ridleys are the smallest turtles. They tend to live in shallow water, and they tend to all nest in this, something called an arrabata. In 3 days, they do all the nesting. And so it's easy pickings. You just stand out there and you pick them up. They would take the turtles for food. They would take the eggs for food. A huge amount of poaching. Green turtles themselves in the largest nesting location in Melbourne Beach in Florida, they were down to 54 nests in the 80s. They attributed to maybe 8 female turtles. I was there this summer and they had 10,000 nests.
But the returning sea turtles are prolific enough to, left to their own devices, once again are protected at the site, are able to build those numbers of nests back up again?
Well, it had a lot to do with human intervention. I mean, on the bad end and on the good end. I mean, the turtles got down to that level because of poaching, because of international commerce, you know, sending it. But on the positive end is conservation. The Endangered Species Act, this is an incredible example of conservation and the benefits of that action is that beaches have been protected. Because shrimpers now have to have TEDs, turtle exclusion devices, in their nets to allow turtles to leave, we don't have those kind of problems. Because beaches have been protected in a lot of places, turtles have a place to come back to. What I find amazing about turtles is what they provoke in people. And the conservation efforts that are done by tens of thousands of volunteers and marine biologists to protect these beaches and to protect the ocean. Turtles have provoked that. So the resiliency, in a way, isn't just what they've done, but it's what they, in their charismatic way, make people do.
I'm thinking back to my own childhood with a pet turtle. I can't remember the name we gave the turtle, but it's, in the olden days, it seemed like at some point or another, almost all the kids had a pet turtle somewhere for a while. And there's just something to them.
There's something is. I mean, the fact that they live, bring their house with them is what was exciting as a kid. What was exciting to me is I had a little turtle named Spike, and somehow he disappeared, and we thought he was dead, and he was just gone. We lived in this little apartment. And then a few months later, my mom was cleaning up under my bed. There was Spike hibernating in this nest of dust bunnies. He was alive. He lived a little bit longer than that.
Maybe he was trying to get away from something here, David.
That's possible. But yeah, we've had these experiences. That's what I find fascinating. Rather than doing a film about a Nat Geo film of the poor endangered turtle, I decided to take a different tact, is to look at the cultural connections that man has had with turtles for thousands and thousands of years, and how we can reaffirm and reclaim that link. Because although conservation efforts have brought sea turtles back to a much larger extent than they were, they're still threatened in a lot of places. Their future is still uncertain.
At the same time, they've been around for how many millions of years? There's a turtle pop quiz. They may be a little more resilient than we give them credit for.
They are the world's oldest dinosaurs. They've been around for over 100, possibly over 150 million years. They've survived all these mass extinctions from the dinosaur age till today. However, our ability to destroy things around us has increased to the extent that turtles, as I said, their future is up in the air. Many turtles do eat things like jellyfish as they're growing up. When they're adults, the only adult turtle that eats jellyfish is the leatherback that lives on the other side of the world near Australia. But as the babies, they'll eat balloons, they'll eat plastic things that look like jellyfish, and often that'll kill them. The loggerheads, which are the most prevalent sea turtles in this country on the East Coast, they eat almost all their food as adults on the coral reefs. And, of course, the coral reefs themselves are suffering from a number of assaults, particularly climate change. And the bleaching that's going on is killing much of the biomass in these coral reefs. And, of course, the biomass is their food. There's lots that still needs to be done. And because you have this unique situation, these turtles live in the ocean the entire life. A male turtle will never come back to the beach again once it's hatched. And a female turtle will only come back after 30 years and start laying maybe every 2 years. The beach has to be protected and the ocean has to be protected. So they go out and we've done a great job of protecting the ocean. They come back to the same beach where they were born and the beach is gone. The demography of the beach is such that the high tide just kind of washes everything up. They're not coming back.
The ability of turtles to find that exact latitude and longitude of where they were born is really amazing in so many ways, but you really have to sympathize with them that you get to the exact same spot of it is 2 feet underwater now, or it's just not there. That's pretty tough to cope with. It's got to, all that time, and then at the last minute, check the map again. Did I get the right place?
You know, having a brain the size of a walnut and being able to traverse sometimes tens of thousands of miles of ocean, go back to the same beach, it's amazing to be able to do that. But in a way, I see turtles as they're kind of passing the torch back to us, and they're saying, you know, we've been here for 100 million years, but it's your responsibility to make sure that that continues.
This is Our Southern Community. I'm speaking with David Weintraub, Executive Director for the Center for Cultural Preservation. We will be back with the second half of our program and connect with some cultural aspects of turtles. We are back again for the second half of our program on Our Southern Community with David Weintraub, discussing turtles and cultural preservation and more. David, the length of the turtles being around on planet Earth, 100, 150 million years, is obviously a long time, but it seems that the awareness, the linkage to turtles with humans, human species in some way, pretty much goes back to the beginning when we became human. It's far back in history. I know I've seen pictures of cave drawings that included turtles in them. It's been a part of the human cultural society since the beginning of human cultural society.
It's true. Some archaeologists have found remnants, what they call mittens, of old crafts that have been built and constructed by early man. And some of the earliest ones are turtles. Well, going back to Oman, I think 5,000 years ago, Oman is a central place for turtles, for sea turtles. And they found graves of some of the kings and queens of society buried next to the turtle, head-to-head with the turtle. So that relationship has been very, very strong and very powerful. Turtles are considered gods in a lot of cultures. They've been a symbol of vitality, of fertility, of strength, of wisdom. Part of it is just their longevity, their perseverance in the face of all kinds of circumstances. What's interesting to me is that even though they've been a ready food source since man discovered they were turtles, they were never reached a point of endangerment until closer in time in society. The Pacific Islanders would revere turtle. They would eat them, but they would only eat them for special occasions, and only the elite were allowed to eat them. And of course, they kept everything. The shell had a certain purpose, and everything had a certain purpose. Turtles, in many cultures, had this specific revered status. And that changed a lot as Western culture came to America. Western culture came to, you know, the quote-unquote uncivilized society, where all of a sudden turtles became this major food source. Columbus, in his last expedition to America, it was a failed expedition. His boats were sinking, all of his food was rotten, he didn't know where he was going, as usual.
That's a whole nother show. But go ahead, David. Sorry to interrupt.
And in his logs, it indicates, oh, thank God we found these tortoises. They called them tortoises at that time. And it's these sea turtles that allowed these people to survive, for better or for worse, and to be able to live another day. As these turtles were discovered, they started to be shipped back to the old world and became a source of food and a delicacy. And in a very short period of time, the records show that the turtle population was depleting rapidly.
And it's a similar experience to the passenger pigeon's extinction when the settlers got here. It would blacken the skies, according to the reports, and they're extinct now. It just shot them all.
Yeah. That's true. Very much so. In green turtles are the only vegetarian turtles. And so they apparently have a special taste that other turtles didn't have. And they're also very beautiful turtles. And so those were the ones that were going extinct a lot faster. Some of the other turtles, it took a little while longer. The hawksbill turtles are the most beautiful of turtles, many people feel. And they were going extinct because the shells were so beautiful that people were buying. You know, the shells were made out of all kinds of crafts, including the shells were retained themselves, and they were disappearing at a very fast clip. But that connection with culture, to me, the look of excitement on the face of children, of turtle patrol people, of marine biologists, of archaeologists, of anthropologists, indigenous population itself, to me, that is so powerful. That really is the story in my mind. Is that we've had this long-term relationship. One of the tribes in the southeast coast in South Carolina is the Waccamaw and the Edisto Indians. And the sea turtle played a very important role as an icon in their culture. The peace pipe that they smoke has a sea turtle on it. That reverence. They call America Turtle Island because in their stories, the earth was formed on the back of a turtle shell.
And that comparison, that idea of Turtle Island is still with us today, and Turtle Island and Eustis Conway, not too far from here, and in the more spiritual level of things, that traces back to that same idea.
And I think it all goes back to just spending some time on the beach. I've lived by the ocean for a lot of my life, but I'd never seen a sea turtle. And it wasn't until I moved to the mountains that I finally got to see the sea turtle when I was on vacation. So when I left ECO and began to focus on the Center for Cultural Preservation, I was thinking of how do I tell the story of the environment from the perspective not on those bad terrible so-and-sos and what they're doing, and this, you know, how the civilization is falling apart in a handbasket. You know, how do you tell the story from the positive standpoint? You know, not to put rosy-colored glasses on, but how do you tell the story from our human connection? What was considered, what's called E.O. Wilson, I think, characterized it as biophilia, this genetic cellular connection that we have for nature. And he studied trees and showed how, on an evolutionary basis, we have this connection with trees just because they were a source of, we hid from the saber-toothed tiger who was running to get us. You know, it was a source of food, it was a source of shade, it was a source of transpiration, you know, it was a source of water, protection for the rivers and streams. And so I see that very closely with turtles. When people see a mama turtle coming from the ocean and struggling and lumbering across the beach and laying the eggs, and for the green turtle, it takes 4 hours to lay their eggs. And to watch this turtle, the sand is pouring in her mouth, and the soil, the sand is all over her. She digs this hole so deep you can't even imagine that she can get out.
I've seen some video of it. It's fascinating, amazing. The flippers are flapping and the sand is flying, and it's a flurry of activity. Are the eggs laid once a year, every 2 years, did you say? How often do the females come back?
Typically, once they're sexually mature, and as I said, it usually takes 30 years before they reach that point, and they have to get through quite a gauntlet before they get there. They usually lay every other year, and in the year that they're laying, it might be every 2 weeks. I think with loggerheads and green turtles, it tends to be every 2 weeks. So they'll lay maybe four or five nests in a summer, and their season in this part of the world, green turtles and loggerheads, tends to be May to July or August, September, depending on which part of the East Coast you're talking about. They typically come on the high tide, so they don't have to go very far to lay their nest. But when they're leaving, the high tide is long since passed, and you watch that mother just like, now what do I do? How am I? And some of these beaches, I mean, it's a huge walk to get from the high tide line back to the ocean. And you see huffing and puffing and sitting there. Sometimes you think the mother is dead. She's just like trying to gather herself and gather her energy to get back to the ocean. And so just imagine these native tribes watching that for generation after generation, that perseverance, that continued, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it somehow. I'm going to get through all the obstacles and do it. It's a source of inspiration, I think. It's a source of inspiration today, 100 million years later.
David, your project now has brought you back to the beach with the video gear. You've been at the Florida shores, on the boats, and really getting a first-hand look at this for your project. You basically mentioned it briefly. You caught a boil when they came out, but there's a lot more going on that you've seen in the last, 2 months now since you've been down to Florida?
Yeah, I was actually in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida for several months in the summertime. I was able to, fortunately, get on this scientific expedition. They had an old shrimper boat, and so they were trawling. And instead of the typical trawling for shrimp for 2 hours, and without a Ted, the turtle would die, they were trawling for turtles to see how they were doing in the ocean. We started off in South Carolina, went down to Florida, and we pulled up a couple of dozen turtles, some loggerheads, mostly loggerheads, some Kemp's Ridleys and green turtles. They would pull them out, they would test their blood, they would size them, see how their health was. They would tag them all. And then the largest male loggerhead that they found, they actually put a satellite tracking device on the turtle shell to be able to see what's going on with it. In fact, if you go to seaturtle.org, you can see Eastman, the loggerhead, and you can track how he's doing in his expedition. He just kind of stayed in one place for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Where in the world is Eastman now? Is that Waldo move over? But that's fascinating. I'm jumping in, but that's fascinating. That would give the opportunity for a literal trail mapping of where the turtle's going or not.
Yes, it does, because there was a lot of turtle experts for years. They would call the lost years of the turtle, because they knew, you know, they'd come from the nest, and then they'd go to the Sargasso Sea, and all of a sudden they'd disappear, and then, you know, 30 years later, there was the mom, and it was very difficult for them to figure out where they go, because some of them will travel only a few hundred miles, but leatherback can travel 10,000 miles. So the tracking devices really help understand what's going on, what kinds of things might be affecting them. This turtle has gone, I think, about 50 1,500 kilometers since it was released. So the Turtle Expedition was an amazing way to get an upfront, close feel of the turtle themselves, but also the marine biologists who are so dedicated to keeping these turtles alive. I spent a couple of weeks with some turtle patrols on the beach. I went to three turtle hospitals in the south. The most incredible thing of all, and I probably have been using that word about 15,000 times in this interview, was Melbourne Beach, which is Loggerhead Central. They had 12,000 loggerhead nests this year and 10,000.
12,000?
12,000.
Wow.
In a 26-mile stretch. And green turtles, and I remember green turtles, I said, were down to like 300 nests. They had 10,000. They had never had so many nests in the history of recorded history, 10,000 green turtle nests. So that, again, is this amazing story of conservation. But you go there on this beach at night, and it is like being in a super highway because you look at this tracks everywhere. In fact, the only way they can possibly figure out what the new tracks are is they drive an ATV along the beach to cover the old tracks so they can figure out what the new tracks are the next morning. There's tracks everywhere, and I was on the beach filming with these scientists, and everywhere I looked, there was a nesting turtle. It was just a fascinating experience, and just to watch them lay the eggs, watch them do what they do, and to go back out to the ocean. And watch the graduate students and the scientists just be amazed at the process. It was a really a fascinating experience.
Does the emergence from the nests of all the baby hatchlings happen in a simultaneous fashion? Is it going on for a couple of weeks every evening? I'm taking it it's a nocturnal event?
Typically, it's a nocturnal event because one of the other fascinating things about turtles is they can tell the temperature. And so when the temperature gets cool enough in the sand, the hatchlings, they tell themselves, okay, it's time to go. And for loggerheads, anyway, it's usually 45 to 60 days later that they'll hatch. They'll typically do that all at the same time. Sometimes they'll do it in the daytime. If it's cloudy and the sand still might be cool, they don't know. They'll pop out and go out to the ocean. And just watching these little things that have no feet, you know, no legs, just flippers, you know, get themselves out to the ocean. It's both heart-wrenching and incredible to watch at the same time. So I was there during the time when nesting season was ending and hatching season was just beginning. So I got to kind of see both
and ends. An overlap of the whole thing. Yeah. Most of the pictures and videos that I've seen, it seemed like it was a nocturnal thing, and a lot that related with that in terms of humans was keeping the beach dark so they didn't get a false signal to go the wrong way.
That's important because they do respond to light, and that's one of the biggest issues is turtles, you know, crossing highways and crossing, you know, going to the condo pool instead of going to the ocean because the lights are on. When I'm filming, by the way, I never use white lights. I'm only using infrared lights, and turtles can't see infrared, just like humans can't really see infrared. So they don't know what I'm doing as long as, and once they start nesting, they get into a trance. They don't get disturbed very easily. But light is one of the problems. People who leave things on the beach, an innocuous thing like kids building a castle. Well, it's nice to build a castle, but you need to put it back and cover the sand because those big holes generally are traps. You know, it's heartbreaking to wake up in the morning and see baby loggerhead hatchlings stuck in this hole dead because they couldn't get out.
You mentioned earlier, David, a turtle hospital. What are the problems that they face? I mean, there's a joke in there somewhere, somehow, but with the patient, how do you tell?
It's usually alcoholism. Having to put up with all the human problems. It's interesting. In some places, in the heavily populated areas, there's this terrible disease called fibril papilloma. It's a tumor disease, and it only affects green turtles, so it's probably something in the plant food, the effluents that's coming out. South Florida has two locations where these turtles are getting it. Hawaiian Islands is the other place. And it's almost certain that it's coming from effluents, like people's sewer systems and septic tanks, fertilizer and runoff from agriculture. Many of the things they're seeing at turtle hospitals are boat strikes, turtles caught in nests, turtles swallowing things that shouldn't be in the ocean. Most of the people are listening to the show in the mountains, and they'll say, well, you know, there's nothing I do that's going to affect turtles. Well, guess where all of our rivers and lakes drain into? They drain into the Gulf of Mexico, or they drain into the Atlantic Ocean. You know, I've been told by some of these Turtle Hospital people, they've seen helium balloons from memorials in Ohio that they found in South Florida. And those balloons, as far as a turtle is concerned, is a jellyfish. So what we do in our own backyard not only affects the turtle population and the natural heritage population in our backyard, but we cast a wide shadow far beyond the mountains. So the balloons and the pollution, the things we do, the runoff from our own backyard, certainly has an effect in Western North Carolina and beyond.
David, all this work on the Turtle Project, and I'm using that term generically at this stage, will hopefully come to public fruition in the spring of 2014. I'm taking a guess.
Spring of 2014 would be the most hopeful projection. More likely, it'll be the end of the summer, early fall. I am putting previews together as I complete different portions of it, and that goes up on the center's website so people can find it there. There are some things from the other documentaries I've done in the past up there, as well as a little piece about this preview of the turtle film. And the turtle film right now, the working title is The Call of the Ancient Mariner. I expect the film to be on PBS, to be at film festivals, to be at screenings, so I want to get it right. There's a little bit of filming still to do. There's a biophilia expert in California that I'm hoping to interview via Skype, a Waccamaw powwow in South Carolina in a couple of weeks to film them, who have that very deep and long-standing connection to turtles. And after that, I should be done with the filming, and I go to post-production.
And I think it's worth pointing out that your hope that it's on PBS and such is should technically be again. You've already been distributed, as it were, quite publicly with some of your other films.
I've been fortunate that two of my first films were on PBS stations around the country and at film festivals around the world. So it's heartening to know that thousands of people are watching your film and to get feedback from the film. But to be honest, the most important way to show a film is to show it to the public, have public showings where you can talk to the audience later, because this is not a dinner and a film kind of thing.
It's not entertainment.
It's not entertainment. It's not escapism. It's the talk after about these issues and how important and how people can leave that theater living their lives in a little different way, because everything comes down to the fact that our consumer lifestyle has consequences. And if we change that, we not only live happier lives, but we also save the natural heritage that depends on us living happier lives.
David Weintraub, Executive Director for the Center for Cultural Preservation, thank you very much for a fascinating interview, discussion, and outlook on turtles. And if folks would like to get in touch with you,
saveculture.org.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Archived programs are available at oursoutherncommunity.org. Your comments, criticisms, and suggestions for programming are encouraged at info@oursoutherncommunity. You can also register for free workshops in the Our Solar Community Energy Project. I'm your host, Ned Ryan Doyle. Thanks for joining us, and have a great week.